Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Well, good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, it's the 29th of June, and I'm running behind on my schedule, which is not very, very good. And I couldn't get off the phone. I had to take that call, and it's encroached on our time slot. So bear with me a moment as I try to find the number for our professor, who probably tried to reach out to us before, but because we weren't on, he never got through. And so I'm going to give him a call in a second, which was my fault, and hopefully we'll get it done right. So forgive me for the delay. Bear with me a second here. Okay, so I think I should be able to get it done now. Bear with me as I try to dial up the number. Okay. All right, so we're going to be dialing him right now, and hopefully that'll go through. Okie dokie.
Hello.
Good morning, Professor. What a pleasure to get a hold of you. My apologies for being delayed. I couldn't get off the phone. So, again, my apology. How are you, sir?
Fine, thank you.
Well, thank goodness. Well, I just should tell people, because I had no time even for an introduction, that we're speaking to socioeconomic research scholar Orrin M. Levin-Waldman, who's on the line now. He has his own website called Econ Labor, and you could find it at econlabor.com. And you could find all his essays. And the most recent essay that he's kind enough to share with our listeners and our readers is the one that he's titled, Has the Supreme Court Ended Equality? And that is such a, it seems like a, such a simple question, and yet there's so much complexity in it. So, Professor, how is it that we don't fully comprehend whether there is equality, or is it that everything is now thrown up in the air and we don't know what is up or down or sideways? Is that the problem?
Well, equality means different things to different people.
Exactly.
There's procedural equality, there's substantive equality. There's equality of the social justice movement, which is gender and racial equality. It has different meanings for different people, and it has different meanings in terms of law as well.
Well, I guess everyone is now more scared than ever before, because no one ever thought that the body or the organ of government that would undermine and usurp the, the comfort zone of so many people, especially with dismantling the rights of women to an abortion, and also now the Supreme Court is suggesting, well, they also want to get rid of rights for gays and other things. It seems that everything is falling apart, but who would have thought that the people who would dismantle our government would be from the Supreme Court? They don't have an army, but evidently we're listening to them.
Well, I mean, defenders of the Supreme Court will basically respond that if you're creating a right out of thin air or out of whole cloth, whatever, but if you can't locate the right specifically in the language of the Constitution, it's not a secure right. So at any time down the road, it can be whatever opinion granted you that right can easily be overturned. And that's why it's preferable to leave the definition of rights to legislative bodies, bodies that are elected by the people. This is basically the fundamental argument of judicial restraint. You should defer to the will of legislative bodies and not let justices on a court, especially justices who are appointed for life, make these kinds of decisions.
Well, I thought there are those that are called originalists and those that are being, innovative and forward-thinking, But wasn't that the purpose of the Constitution, to allow for progression over time, and for different circumstances to come about that would challenge the mind and I guess the demeanor of a nation and of a people, and eventually we would move ahead. But isn't that the purpose of the U.S. Constitution? Isn't it a living, breathing organ that shouldn't be going back 100 years?
Well, again, it depends who you ask. It really is a question of who you ask. It's a matter of interpretation. So, you know, the more liberal-minded people will say it should be a living, breathing document. The fact that it's a short document as opposed to a long 200-page document, which is, you know, typical of any number of state constitutions, means it's so broad, it can be interpreted and reinterpreted according to changing times. That's what makes this Constitution somewhat unique. That having been said, it's not clear that that was the intent, that it should stand for all time and be a living, breathing document. I mean, I'm not sure the framers really thought about that. And the framers certainly did not think about what the role of the Supreme Court would be. They just didn't really even define what the court was. And they didn't even define the concept of judicial review. And they left it for the court to decide for itself what judicial review meant. So it's fair to say that the framers really had no idea what the role of the court would be. And in fact, when the court proceeded to define this concept called judicial review in Marbury versus Madison, it almost unleashed a wave of impeachments against the Supreme Court, led by the Jeffersonians of all people. So, you know, it's this idea that there's been tranquility between the branches of government is utter nonsense. There has been tension between the branches since the beginning of the Republic, and because the role of the court is undefined, there have been movements any number of times in history to strip the court of its power or to impeach justices. So, I mean, you know, in the 1930s, when the court was invalidating newly legislation, Franklin Roosevelt sought to pack the court in order to get a court which would be more agreeable to him. It didn't work. Many people in his own party felt that's tampering with a sacred institution. In the 1950s, when the court ruled on desegregation cases handed down, Brown versus the Board of Education, you had people calling for, you know, impeachment of the justices. How dare they defy the will of the people? The idea was, if a Democratic legislative body in Arkansas wants to discriminate against, that's their right as a majority in Arkansas. How dare the court interfere and create these rights, these civil lives, liberties, civil rights? So there's always been that tension between those who argue for judicial restraint and those who argue for judicial activism.
You know, to be honest, I have to admit that I guess I'm just not immersed enough to have recognized it. I just took it for granted that there was a progression in the mindset of the Supreme Court, or that it would lead to a progression. So what drives in the Supreme Court's decisions, or is it different for every different issue? So is there a drive for equality? Can we bring about equality? How do we even define equality? And as you always point out, you can go to the same college and earn the same degree, and yet there's a different capacity to the people that graduate. Even both of them may graduate cum laude, but that doesn't mean that they will be both equally successful. There may be other attributes or things that take away or detract from their capacity to be successful. So is there a way to balance it all out, or just we being foolish and naive? There is no way to bring everyone on the same level.
Well, it is naive to believe that we could all be equal. I mean, we're not all equal. We all have different capacities,
yeah.
different attributes, there's different endowments, and we have different
yeah.
interests. So some of us are going to pursue a career in A, which doesn't pay as well, as opposed to a
mm-hmm.
career in B, which pays extraordinarily well. Now, if we
yeah.
are free to make those choices, irrespective of our attributes, then the outcomes are deemed to be somewhat fair. That having been said, the court has not really been concerned about defining equality in substantive terms, because the Constitution says nothing about economic equality. Basically, it uses the language of, you know, equal protection clause, equal protection under the law, which comes from
mm-hmm.
the 14th Amendment. And it, I think it needs to be pointed out, the 14th Amendment was designed to correct the imbalances between the states. So what you have here is the idea of the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause is the idea that you don't create invidious classifications between people, because that would, in fact, be discriminatory. So where the Equal Protection Clause has been used is if you have a right that's recognized or defined. For example, you have in the same amendment, you have privileges and immunities. So that is, whatever privileges and immunities you enjoy in New York, you should enjoy the same privileges and immunities in Alabama. So that's kind of been
mm-hmm.
understood to mean if you're married in the state of New York, then your marriage license will be recognized as legitimate in Alabama. Now, the question is marriage a right? That's the first question. And the Supreme Court is
uh-huh.
basically saying in the case of abortion, since it's not well-defined right, it's not an established right, then it doesn't even rise to the level of a privilege and immunity. So therefore, it doesn't mm-hmm. count. But what the Roe Court did in 1973 is it basically relied on precedents in contraception cases to say, okay, so if a couple can make a decision in privacy not to get pregnant in the first place, then they can make a
mm-hmm.
similar decision to in privacy to terminate a pregnancy in the second place. So basically, and then what they said was, okay, now we're going to use the Equal Protection Clause to strike down the Texas state statute, which criminalized abortion. So in a sense, what it's saying is because then you're not treating Texas residents the same as you're treating residents across the country. So here's the problem with Alito's ruling or his majority
mm-hmm.
opinion. I mean, you can say all you want that there's no established right to have an abortion in the Constitution. And technically, in a literal sense, he's right. It doesn't say anything about a right to an abortion. But it does say in the Ninth
right.
Amendment that you, whatever rights the framers at the time had not thought about are rights that were reserved to the people. Now, those are the two ways to look at that. It could be reserved to the people. In other words, if the people have a right to decide what those rights will be, they could decide at the national level, they could decide, or they could decide at the local level. So it's, you know, in theory, then a leader would be right if he said, if the people decide they don't want that to be a right in 2022, then it's not a right. Now, but still the problem remains. If once you have an opinion which effectively tosses the issue of abortion back to the states. In other words, it doesn't terminate abortion. It doesn't end it altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also worth pointing out that Alito says nothing in his opinion about life, because there is
mm-hmm.
no right to life in the Constitution. So it doesn't say it's about life. Basically, it's saying there was no right to have an abortion. Therefore, Roe v. Wade can't stand. Therefore, the case has to go back to the states to decide for themselves what they're going to do. Okay, so now if New York could allow for abortions, Alabama does not. People in New York have inherently more rights than the people in Alabama. In a broader sense, that violates the spirit of the Equal Protection Clause. We're not all equal across the country. In other words, we're not equal by virtue of the fact we had the misfortune of being born in certain states which don't allow it. We're victims of geography. And the question is, well, was that something that maybe the authors of the 14th Amendment might have been concerned with? We don't really know what their concerns were. But we should be mindful of the consequences of a decision that we're about to make when we are judging things. And I think that's a fair criticism of the court. In other words, you know, some people say, well, you're supposed to interpret the law as it is. But you're supposed to be interpreting the law mindful of the consequences of the decision that you'll be handing down, because the consequences can be enormous. And it's going to reverberate around the country and around the world, for that matter. And I think we're going to see that, consequences which nobody thought would be possible. For example, I could see a situation whereby some states are going to criminalize the procedure, in which case doctors will be charged with murder if they perform abortions in those particular states. I can also see a situation where some states, like Alabama, may try to extradite doctors who perform abortions on people who travel from Alabama to New York. Say, well, it's our citizen, you had no right to do it, therefore you committed murder, so we want to extradite you. Obviously, that's going to be hard to enforce, and New York has no intention of extraditing its doctors to Alabama. But I also could see a situation whereby Alabama may try, it would be very difficult to do it, but they may try to limit or prohibit pregnant women from traveling for fear that they may actually leave the state to go have an abortion. People may think this is absurd, but I think given the mindset of some of these legislators down south in particular states, it's not really out of the realm of possibility.
What about the whole concept of, do we actually believe that men and women are equal, or are women inferior because they're women? And should we be protecting their integrity as a human being? Or what happens if there is incest or rape and they have no way of stopping becoming impregnated through that process? So is there equality, or is the biological reality going to keep women from having independence from the circumstances that could harm them, especially when because it could be uncalled for? She's not asking to get raped. She's not asking for someone to impregnate her, and that's an incestuous situation. And why should she have to suffer 20 years of raising a child that she never wanted in the first place? How do we bridge that? Or are we still living in the 1700s?
Well, we may be living in the 1500s as far as men are concerned, but I think it's not so easy to bridge that gap. But I think the problem is that on the one hand, the 14th Amendment is designed to correct that imbalance because it's basically prohibiting invidious classifications. So you can't treat people based on gender differently than one gender differently from another gender. On the other hand, from the pro-life position, a life in the womb is no less of a life because it's the product of rape and incest. So it's inherently still life. So you've got a problem here. And then if you could say, well, rape and incest, why can't you make, say, emotional distress? If emotional distress, economic hardship. You could take off the list of reasons for why you would do it. So they're going to say slippery slope. But it doesn't change the fact that, you're basically forcing somebody to carry the term of baby they don't want to have, especially if it's a product of rape and incest. There's something else here. Mm-hmm. I think another line of attack for protecting a right to have an abortion would have been to attack it on the First Amendment grounds, basically say, look, it's not, it's a violation of the free exercise of religion if Group A can impose their religious viewpoint on Group B, which is essentially what you're doing if you're saying, okay, so the evangelical position, which is a strict position, which also mirrors the Catholic Church's position, would be, we don't make exceptions to save the life of the mother because the mother's already been baptized. So it's more important to save the baby than to save the life of the mother. That's not a view shared by other religions, especially Judaism. So it's a very problematic thing. And you basically are saying, in effect, when you can, don't make those exceptions, you're saying that what Group B does not enjoy the same right to religious free expression as Group A.
Mm-hmm. So is it conceivable that the Supreme Court really is an anachronism that should not even exist? Because they're not balanced in their final decision because maybe there is no way to balance all these different aspects of an issue. And it is not the original thinking because we have no idea what the thinking was at the time that substantiated what they did write down. And as you say, we don't really know exactly where they were going or what their intent was. Or if the language was sufficiently clear to understand that it should evolve or not evolve. But is this going to tear us apart as a nation?
I mean, it could tear us apart. It wouldn't be the first time the Supreme Court has ruled in such a way, fashion that the country was torn apart. I mean, you know, the Civil War was basically, in some ways, it began not when troops fired at Fort Sumter, but when the Supreme Court handed down Dred Scott and basically said a slave has been taken across state lines into a free country, had no right to sue. And so it's a free state, had no right to sue for his freedom because he's not a citizen. Actually, it went further. He's not even a person.
Yeah.
Therefore, he has no rights.
Yeah.
That was, by many scholars' accounts, the beginning of the end and the march towards the Civil War. Now, you know, that's, you know, if you, the tension between the national government and states basically was played out in the Supreme Court from 1787 until 1865. Okay, so the court would basically rule in favor of national authority because it wanted to give itself a role in this national government. Otherwise, it had no role. And there was no reason to believe that the faith would adhere to a ruling of the Supreme Court, unless the ruling was deemed to be reasonable. So this has led to the belief that many judicial rulings, particularly in the early years, were designed to stay within the mainstream of what was believed to be public opinion at the time. You wouldn't stray too far from the mainstream of public opinion for fear that the court would lose its so-called legitimacy. So in other words, if you're within the mainstream of public opinion, then there's a sense that your rulings are, in fact, reasonable. So that's why you have a situation that between 1804 or 1803, whenever Marbury versus Madison was handed down, the first ruling which basically invalidated an act of the National Congress, okay? The court did not rule against the Congress again until 1857 in Dred Scott, and it rarely did it afterwards, until the New Deal. So basically, and every time it would do this, it would say, we take the topic of the issue of ruling against the national government with utmost sincerity. We take this very seriously because, you know, we just can't take this lightly. And they would pontificate, then they would issue their ruling. Now, the cases that you had during this period. The early 1800s and 1857 were basically rulings against state governments, where the courts tried to establish this concept of national authority. So basically the court has tried to be careful. And in a sense, Roberts is probably the ultimate institutionalist on the court. Mm-hmm. While he's a conservative justice, I think he's very mindful of how the court is viewed by the public and how the court is viewed in history. And I think he sees the role of the court to be limited in its reach and not be there to issue broad, wide-ranging opinions that basically transform the country. He doesn't see that as the role of the court. He'd like to stay within the confines of public things. So I guess my guess is, if it were up to him, and I think he was trying to lobby for this, was, okay, uphold the Mississippi regulation of after 16 weeks you can't have an abortion, or whatever the regulation was. Mm-hmm. And then, but still uphold the precedent of Roe v. Wade. I think that's what he wanted to do. Basically, so the court would not be threatened. It really would question legitimacy and so on and so forth. He seems to have lost that battle. Did he lose it because a draft of the opinion was leaked? We'll never know. Was he going to lose it anyway? But I think he tried. And that's a lot of conservatives fault him for this. And he doesn't stand by principle. He's basically acting like he's a political body. But the court has acted like it's a political body. If it's trying to stay within the mainstream of public opinion, then by all measures, it's a political body, just like the presidency and just like the Congress.
Well, is it conceivable that we're as a nation of people, not in government, we vote people into government, we appoint them to the Supreme Court, and they have all these positions, but is the human species, are we balanced enough? Do we have an equilibrium that we can count on and say, well, these people are really just very, very balanced. They could see this side and that side, and they come up with a conclusion that we may not be because of their knowledge, their education, and so on and so forth, or are they as frail and as faulty as the rest of us? So, should they have that right to make these laws?
Well, I guess that's the heart of the debate between judicial restraintists and judicial activists. Restraintists basically say, no, court should not have that right. This is meant for the demos. In democratic society, then legislative bodies should make those decisions. What we've had since Roe v. Wade came down was a refusal by legislative bodies to take responsibility to make these decisions. So they've been hiding behind the court. So as long as the court preserves and protects the right of women to choose to have an abortion or not to have an abortion, then Republicans can basically go hit the campaign trail and say, absolutely, I'm pro-life. Okay. Mm-hmm. And all Democrats can hit the campaign trail and say, absolutely, I'm pro-choice, when in fact many of them are not on either side. And one can only imagine, one hopes, that we're going to see more and more politicians come out and say, well, my position is real, especially the Republican Party, we're going to see more of them come out and say, I'm really am pro-choice because, you know, that's the way to get elected. And I think, you know, that's probably a good thing. You want the legislative body to basically rise to the occasion and make these kinds of decisions. Now, what can the legislative body do? That's a question unto itself. Can they pass a national abortion law, which basically guarantees the right of a woman to choose? I suppose in theory they could do that. The question is whether you could count on states like Alabama to enforce it. And in some ways it would be similar to passing the Voting Rights Act in 1955, whereby you initially had southern states that refused to enforce it. And the only way
right.
it became enforceable was when the federal government stepped in and basically said, look, either you enforce this act or we're going to withhold highway funds or whatever federal
right.
monies that you've become accustomed to, which they can still do. At first, places like Mississippi and Alabama said, fine, with all our highway funds, we couldn't care less. And we're not enforcing the Civil Rights Law, we're not enforcing the Voting Rights Act. So it basically would have to be tied to that kind of enforcement. And still, you'd have a system where you don't have broad-based equality because, you know, again, people in one state have inherently more rights than citizens of another state.
Well, does this all mean at the end of the day that every law that has been passed by the Supreme Court since its inception may fall because that's what that's what the Supreme Court justice said, that he's going after gay rights and so on and so forth? Where are they? Where do they have the right to make a judgment call? Or to pass judgments, and where do their rights stop, or are their rights do they have more rights than everybody else does? Because I'm not equal to a Supreme Court justice, but do they have the knowledge to make all these decisions? Because some of them seem faulty. Why did they allow something to be sitting on the books for 50 years and all of a sudden it's expunged because, is there money involved in all of this? It seems like a lot of money is involved. The wife of the Supreme Court justice is making a fortune being a political operative.
Well, I mean, there's money to be made being a Supreme Court justice and writing books. I mean, apparently some of these justices, like Amy Coney Barrett, has a $2 or $3 million book deal and had a $400,000 or $500,000 advance. So there's money to be made because you are on the court. That having been said, a lot of people feel strongly that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided. Most liberal justices, people who support a woman's right to choose, will basically say it was a bad decision. And
okay.
if you read the decision, it's not well reasoned. And basically, it says in the opinion itself that there's something called fetal viability. So as technology advances, the fetus will become more viable, and the state can regulate on the basis of a compelling interest. So that's already the basis for regulation, for restricting women's right to choose, is already written, baked into the language of Roe v. Wade. And even Ruth Bader Ginsburg, certainly a staunch supporter of women's right to choose, basically said, this is a faulty opinion. That's where this is coming from. Now the questions are the other cases. Because Roe v. Wade rests on as predicates Griswold versus Connecticut, which is your first contraception case, and Eisenstadt versus Baird, which is a second contraception case. In other words, Griswold basically was the right of people in privacy to practice contraception who are married. Eisenstadt versus Baird was the right of an unmarried couple in privacy to practice contraception. But Justice Douglas and Griswold basically said, recognized there was no established right in the Constitution to such privacy. He said it was in the penumbra of the Constitution. He said, in many penumbras, in other words, this is the spirit of the Constitution, therefore we find this so-called right. Okay, so if there's no such right to abortion, then there probably is no such right to practice contraception. And that's where I think people have to be concerned, because I think there is an agenda for some people to roll the clock back and basically ban contraception because, you know, in the words of Lawrence Tribe in a book that he wrote on abortion, where he has a very extensive history of abortion laws in the 1800s, basically the goal is to criminalize sexual activity outside of marriage.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So where do we go from here? Are we just stalemated because no one knows exactly what their rights are, what their rights may not be, and that there is no equality between citizens of one state and another? Are we going to see a movement of population from one state to the other because people say, well, I can't live here because, God forbid, I get raped and I don't want, as a child, I don't have the legal right to an abortion. So we're going to have people coming to New York. And who's going to pay for all of this? You know, New York pays for a lot of the rights that they enjoy in Alabama because they get money from us. Because we're putting more into the coffers than they are. Same thing with California. But what do we do about all these things? Or is there just no way to create equality because there is no equality? And we have to own up to that.
Well, I mean, again, we need the definition of what equality and equal protection under the law means. And I think, you know, again, the court has had a limited understanding of it. I think it needs a broader understanding of it. Now, and I can see the criticism being, okay, so if you're mindful of that, people have enjoyed inherently more rights than others, therefore the certain standards should be upheld. Then why not have, you know, national laws for drinking and other things, you know, because, you know, the same idea applies that, you know, by allowing states to make decisions for themselves, people have inherently more rights in those particular states. And I think what's lost in this debate is that the 14th Amendment was designed to correct for the imbalances between states. Basically, the reason it was passed was ratified. Well, first it was rammed down the throats of southern states because it was basically passed before they were readmitted back into the Union. But the reason it was passed was because the national government was saying at the time, you guys are untrustworthy guardians of people's basic civil rights. You enslaved the whole population, half the country. We can't trust you. Therefore, we need this amendment. Now, the conservatives come along. This is where Robert Bork came along, and I don't think that Scalia would disagree with him, he would disagree in most cases. Basically, Bork said, look, Brown versus the Board of Education was wrongly decided. The court made a mistake there because the 14th Amendment was only designed to protect the rights of newly freed slaves. In other words, 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, 13th Amendment and slavery. 14th Amendment protects rights of citizenship. Basically, it starts off, you're born in Alabama, you're a citizen of the United States. That's a response to the ruling in Dred Scott, which said you're not a citizen. Then basically the 15th Amendment is the right to vote. So basically these are three post-Civil War amendments and basically designed to protect the rights of newly freed. That's Bork's opinion. That was, if you go by originalism, that was the intent of these amendments. It has no application to anything today. Doesn't have the right application to rights of the accused, doesn't have rights to applications for people who want to desegregate the schools, and so it doesn't have rights application for substance due process, issues like privacy.
It looks like we're in a quagmire, but are there other institutions similar to the U.S. The U.S. Supreme Court in other countries? Or are they similarly, challenged? Or is it that we're so different than any other country that there is no comparison? I mean, do they have these problems in England or in France or in Spain or in Argentina?
England has a different system. It's based on English common law. U.S. Supreme Court precedent is a form of common law, I suppose. But I don't think it's written on any written based on any written constitution in England, other than Magna Carta maybe. But you have common law basically. The courts are not necessarily separate from a political branch. I mean, it's, you know, courts are part of the monarchy. That's the whole concept of the king and his courts. Basically, the king's court, so to make decisions or adjudicate cases. Other countries, you have a more civil law tradition, and I think it really goes to the question, this fundamental question, is law the command of the sovereign, or is law something which is natural? You know, do we have natural rights, or do we have rights which are defined by legislative bodies? Well, the reality is, well, if it's a legislative body, then a legislative body can change at any point in time. It's not natural. It's not immutable. But it's also relative. If it's the command of the sovereign, and you see the problem, and this is a problem that people wrestled with, following the end of World War II, and you had the Nuremberg trials. The Nazis basically turned morality on its head, and what was illegal by most standards became legal. It was now lawful to slaughter Jews because it wasn't genocide. It was basically pestified. This is the way they defined it in the code. So, in other words, the question would be, on what basis do you prosecute these people? Because they were simply following the law as they understood it. Whereas the people who talk about natural law say there are certain universal truths out there and principles, and they violated those universal truths and principles. But the law is a command, or basically is what the sovereign says it is, comes back and retorts, look, our basis for prosecuting these people in Nuremberg is because, well, to be blunt, we the Allies won the war, and we can.
That's the only discussion. Validity. That is the only validity, isn't it, at the end of the day? Because if Germany won, then they would have imposed whatever they wanted beyond their borders.
Right.
As they saw fit.
But this has been an ongoing discussion for years, centuries.
Right.
Is law a basis, is a command of the sovereign, or is law natural? So again, if it's a law that goes as sovereign, then the rights of people are based on what the legislature or what the Congress says are rights happen to be. And I think even judicial act restraintists will tell you, those who are conservative minded will say, yeah, absolutely. If the public wants to define certain rights, they have a right to do so. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes basically said, if the people want to take the country to hell, it's their right to do so.
Okay. Fascinating. So at the end, we don't really have rights. It's just we have power. So is that the difference? We have the power to make a decision, and so we have an institution like the Supreme Court that has the power to create this edict, and everybody capitulates to it because they have no means to challenge it. And is that because we're ignorant, or because we don't even understand the way this process works? And the language is so poor by the people who espouse one position or the other that we just capitulate because of our own ignorance and because the language is unclear.
It's going to be a combination of all those things. But I think, you know, a right only has meaning if it can be enforced. And somebody has to be willing to enforce it. And the point of the court is it's the least dangerous branch as Hamilton basically said. Enjoy is neither the power of the person nor the power of the sword. Power of the purse is Congress's ability to fund operations, to appropriate money. The power of the sword is the president's power as commander-in-chief. So he's the one who enforces laws, not the court. So it relies on the goodwill of the political branches of government. That's why I say that the court has to rule in such a way that their rulings are deemed to be reasonable by most people. And when it becomes unreasonable, then you have a lack of enforcement. You know, you can imagine if the court had come out and said, we find Roe v. Wade is wrong, therefore abortion is banned and illegal all throughout the country. There's nobody who would enforce that. And they know they would have had these. They wouldn't have had the authority to do so. At the same time, had they come out and basically did what Roberts was hoping they would do and say, well, you know, we're upholding Roe v. Wade, but we're also upholding the Mississippi statute, which limits the ability to have abortions beyond a certain period of time. Most people, I think, out there would say that's really not too unreasonable. Therefore, you wouldn't be having quite the same protests. You have some protests, but you wouldn't be having the same number of protests.
But one of the issues with that was that a lot of women don't even know that they are pregnant, even 16 weeks after they have become impregnated, because they don't know that, or they don't feel it, I guess. But it would be more acceptable, because it would be, they could say, well, they have 16 weeks to figure it out. So is that where it goes? But that's also not the original aspect of what we wanted to do in law, is it? So can we be smart enough to balance it out between what people understand and what other people don't understand? Or is this a failed system?
I don't think it's a failed system. I think it's a system which has its quirks and a system which, you know, needs some correction at times. But I think,
it can be tweaked.
You have a system which basically creates a separate branch of government to adjudicate cases. If a justice approaches his or her job with a sense of humility, then knowing that the decision can be far-reaching, and also knowing that they are pretty much on the court for life, then they will be modest and say, I really should defer to the will of the legislative body.
Mm-hmm.
Unless I can point to specifically language in a statute or language in the Constitution where it's clear to me that this legislative action is violating somebody's rights, then I have to defer to the will of the legislative body in the first place. I have no right to assert rights that don't exist. And that's really what the court effectively said. Now, the problem is that people said, but for 50 years you basically maintained this as a precedent. And the question is, if it's a precedent, do you still adhere to it if you believe it was wrongly decided? I mean, we've overturned other precedents. I mean, you know, you could basically say, okay, we overturned the precedent of Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal, with Brown versus Board of Education. Do we want to say, but that was a precedent. How dare you overturn that? For equality. I mean, I don't think you want to say that. You want to say it was a precedent because, yes, it was a precedent, but it was wrongly decided. That gave us Brown versus the Board of Education. But some people will say, look, Brown versus the Board of Education is somewhat problematic because the case was based on more social science and less on law. Well, some legal precedents to support it, but this is the first case where you actually had a testimony of social scientists with their statistics showing what the effects of segregated school systems would be. So, in other words, to say that the court lives in a vacuum, totally, you know, not influenced by its surroundings, is not true in the least bit.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So where do we go from here? Or are we just stalemated by, I guess, being overwhelmed that that things are not the way they were yesterday? Is that the problem? We're just, it's like a slap in the face. It's a wake-up call. And what about men? Do men have any influence in any of this? Because what happens to women affects men too, certainly in a heterosexual relationship.
Well, I mean, since there's some people who want to basically say that, you know, men can become women and women can become men, and that therefore they're basically gender identity is fluid, and therefore, you know, maybe there's no longer men and women anymore. So, you know, that's not an issue. And, you know, if you're allowing transitioning men to compete on women's sports teams, then you're basically saying all the protections that you legislated on behalf of women are basically should be erased because, you know, these distinctions no longer exist. So it's unclear how that affects, this decision affects men, but it certainly does allow for states to say, well, you know, we do believe women should be able to choose, but she should also notify her partner.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is going to be, it seems that this is not going to go away. It seems like we'd be at each other's throats on this issue for a very, very long time. This is like literally ripped the nation into shreds, I think. I don't think it'll be very easily overcome. And what will the country do, though? Or are we just now waiting for the ramifications of it? Is it conceivable even the Supreme Court will think about it again? They could revisit if they want to.
I think, well, again, it remains to be seen if a group of states, a group of people from different states, particularly those states where it's banned, might get together, file a class action lawsuit, and basically say, look, this is violating the spirit of the Equal Protection Clause because people in northern states or western states, they have inherently more rights than we do. It violates the essence and spirit, the intent of the Equal Protection Clause. I think we have to be clear and see if such a case comes before the court.
That would be very interesting. That'd be very interesting. And I would presume that the nation would be glued to every word on that one because everyone's affected by all of this.
Not only that, it would also basically be a test of what you mean by original intent because, you know, this has been an ongoing discussion in the last few appointments to the Supreme Court. And while, you know, everyone wanted to hear, well, what did the appointees say about abortion? The question is, what do they say about original intent? What's the judicial philosophy?
Right.
And we didn't have as much discussion on that. We had plenty of that when Bork was appointed to the court. That's why he was defeated. He made it very clear what his philosophy was and what originalism was. I don't think it was quite as developed by him. It was developed even further by Scalia. And Alito is basically, you know, a disciple of Scalia in many respects. This is an original intent, I think, is a threat to this idea that the Constitution can be a living, breathing document, basically limited to a conception of time. In other words, the way you could basically view things in the following fashion. You know, years ago when I was writing a dissertation on why plant closing, what liberalism couldn't accommodate plant closings, you know, my dissertation advisor basically said, well, there's something called a liberal political philosophy, a liberal public philosophy. Or put it another way, if I want to understand liberalism as a political philosophy, I understand in terms of a set of concepts which are not bounded by temporal dimensions. If I want to understand as a liberal public philosophy, I have to understand those concepts as bounded by conceptions in time, the different conceptions of those concepts. And basically what you're having, that same thing applies to interpretations of law and jurisprudence and these phrases in the Constitution. When you're talking about a living, breathing document, you're talking about certain concepts which are there, not bounded by temporal boundaries. When they talk about original intent, they are, many of them are talking about, well, this is what they meant in 1787. The problem is we don't really know what they meant. And the question is, the authors of the 14th Amendment, was their intent only to protect newly freed slaves, or was their intent to protect a broader understanding of equality? So when people talk about original intent, they sort of get mixed up on this because they don't really know. They presume to know, but they don't really know what their intent was. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very dangerous concept. I mean, if you take original intent and say, an NRA type will say, let's appoint a judge, justice, who will believe in original intent. Therefore, we have the right to bear arms. That says so in the language of the Second Amendment. But wait a minute. The Second Amendment was only designed to apply to the national government. An original intent person could come along and say, given that, it limits the federal government in its ability to restrict guns, but it doesn't limit the ability of states to do that. So you've got to be careful about what you're asking for when you're talking about original intent.
Well, I guess, is that one of the problems that the Supreme Court doesn't recognize, that the public is not on the same level as their understanding is? And why don't they explain it better? Wouldn't that have helped ameliorate some of this disgruntlement and this, the defeat by some people who don't understand why we moved in this direction and why we should not move in another? Is that the problem with our politicians? Is that it? Because you're clear. I don't have a problem understanding you.
Well, most people don't understand what law is, and basically it's a very complicated set of concepts and processes. The court is basically responding to what is a lower court ruling, and they're basically deciding based on the case. But, it's written, it's public record. Anybody can read these cases if they want. It's not closed to the public. Whether they understand it or not, it's an open question. But they are really, the justices are really not, they're not writing for the public. They're writing for other judges and in the system who will then apply what they've written to cases before them. That's really what they're doing.
Wow. Well, this is a lot to learn. Well, this has been certainly a major, major lesson, so I wonder if it's going to create an avalanche of discussion into the future, and if that will affect future issues that come before the Supreme Court. This is going to be very, very compelling. Well, as always, Professor, what a thrill. I hope people read Has the Supreme Court Ended Equality? It's a phenomenal essay. Thank you very, very much for your time.
Thank you.
Be well. Take care. Stay healthy. Bye. Well, there we have it, folks. If you want to learn a little bit more about socioeconomic research scholar Orrin M. Levin-Waldman You could do so by visiting his website. The website is www.econlabor.com, and you'll be able to read not only his most recent essay, which you'll also find on the Yonkers Tribune, but you'll also find it written on his website. And I see we already have our second guest, Mr. Max Mikhailov. He's going to be on in a moment, so I'm going to delay him just a moment or so and just quickly give you an understanding of some of the books that the professor has written, because they're very, very compelling. And so bear with me, and I'll give Mr. Mikhailov a little time at the end of our segment so that we won't shorten his length of time in our discussion. So bear with me a moment here. I want to pull this up. You can certainly read his latest essay online. And just so you know, he's written quite a few books, Restoring the Middle Class Through Wage Policy, which are his arguments for a middle class. That was published by Palgrave, P-A-L-G-R-A-V-E. And then Understanding Public Policy in the United States, again by Orrin M. Levin-Waldman. And this is published by Top Hat, T-O-P-H-A-T. And I was introduced to his work for the first time when I read The Minimum Wage, A Reference Handbook, which is issued by ABC-CLIO, and they're a division of ABC-CLIO. It's part of the American Broadcasting Corporation. Then one of the most esoteric publishers in the country, Routledge, R-O-U-T-L-E-D-G-E, they published a work called Wage Policy, Income Distribution, and Democratic Theory by Orrin M. Levin-Waldman. Brilliant work. It's in paperback. And the case of the minimum wage, where he writes about competing policy models, and this was published by the State University of New York Press. All exceptional work. And of course, go to his website to learn more about his perspective, www.econlabor.com, yet the firm is called Labor Econ. So that's the story there. So let's bring in Mr. Mikhailov, who's patiently waiting for me to stop my ranting. So good morning, Mr. Mikhailov. How are you, sir?
Hello. Not ranting at all. How are you?
Well, I'm glad to speak to you. What a pleasure. We should quickly introduce you to our audience. You're a contributor to Medium, an open platform where readers find dynamic thinking, and where expert and undiscovered voices can share their writing on any subject. And you define yourself as a democratic, socialist, queer rights activist. And there's so many words in there, it's hard to, you know, filter out what any of these things totally mean, but it sounds wonderful, very lofty, to say the least. So what is a democratic, socialist, queer rights activist? I think
yeah,
I understand what an
you.
Activist is, but the rest is difficult.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I understand that. You know, I, in general, just consider myself a queer rights activist, but I do like to emphasize the democratic socialist part as well. It's because the history of the queer rights, the queer liberation movement is one that is democratically socialist. You know, a lot of people don't realize this because of the corporate, the current corporate mainstream view of, you know, what Pride Month is, for example. But our roots, you know, our early queer liberation movement leaders like Marsha P. Johnson, a black trans woman, and Sylvia Rivera, a trans Latina, they were fighting for causes like, you know, socioeconomic opportunity, housing justice, the rights of sex workers, comprehensive health care, especially mental health care. And as we know with you know, the Stonewall riots, the Stonewall Rebellion, fighting back the violent police state. And that's why I emphasize that I'm also a democratic socialist, because that is inherent with queer rights activism. And in my opinion, if you're not fighting for progressive policy for the queer community, you're not fighting for real queer needs, because that's also statistically proven. you know, especially with the last presidential election where nationally it was a landslide that queer people wanted Bernie Sanders to be the Democratic nominee, not just not just because of the person, but because of the policy behind it. And, you know, Elizabeth Warren was our second choice. And unfortunately, over the years, you know, there's a beautiful yet tragic video of Sylvia Rivera getting on stage at a Pride event, and she was being booed by many, you know, more wealthy, politically centrist, gay, cisgender white men. You know, not of all, of course, those identities individually are nothing to demonize, but obviously there is a power dynamic there. And she was trying to, you know, they were trying to boo her off stage for bringing these, you know, revolutionary topics forward. And, you know, I'll wrap up my ranting with just saying, you know, we have an issue with a lot of people in our own community trying to exploit our community for their own interests. And I'm just trying to bring back our revolutionary roots to queer rights activism, and we see that, you know, happening across the country.
Well, how is it that the roots have been moved away from all these issues that you bring up? And why does it focus on the sexuality? Is that because it's like an incendiary aspect to undermine the gay community? Is that being used by people who are offended, not by all the rights that they may agree on for other people, but they're just offended by the sexual practices of gay men, gay women? Is that the problem?
I think when we're looking at more conservative forces, they definitely, when they see something they don't understand, you know, fear is, the acronym is false evidence appearing real, right? And it's always, it's ignorance. You know, we have two choices in life, love or fear. So when they see something, other people being inherently who they are, but they don't understand it because they've never seen it in their own lives, different types of love, different types of intimate relationships, different types of gender identities, expressions, they immediately, you know, because it's not in their scope of understanding, in their reality, they then want to delegitimize it and say, well, I have never seen this before, so therefore it somehow is not real, it doesn't exist. And they say horrible, factually incorrect things like this is a choice they made, you know, things like that. So then they demonize it, right? They make it seem like it's a perversion and whatnot. And then to answer your question, you know, over the years, I think as, you know, we live in an oligarchy. We have to face that head on in the U.S. The wealthy run this country. You know, there's great movements happening where people are unionizing, breaking down these corporations. They're saying enough is enough. But, you know, as soon as LGBTQ existence became less stigmatized, corporate entities and the wealthies then said, oh, you know what, it's less stigmatized. Let's see how we can profit off this. And unfortunately, a lot of people within our own community saw this as an opportunity to say, you know, how can I, especially, you know, queer people involved politically and governmentally said, okay, well, how can I uplift myself? How can I benefit from this? And then only to uplift their own career, their own influence, their own profit, said, you know, I'm gonna help these corporate entities, these wealthy individuals, exploit my own community so I can protect myself. And, you know, and that's when we see groups like the National Democratic Party, for example, you know, just pandering. And we see this with local chapters as well, local, state, and federal, pandering to queer needs with like blanket statements of equality, you know, all rainbows and unicorns. And it's like, no, we need the New York Health Act. We need people. We need the billionaires taxed, like just basic things, basic needs like that. And, you know, we need to go further, and we need to just put our defenses down. When we hear that, you know, a lot of Democrats are like, well, what about the Republicans hurting us? And I just find that to be such an offensive low standard, because it's like, we need to approach this from a holistic lens. Of course, the current Republican Party is hurting us, but that doesn't mean we're going to choose least worst. You know, we need to make sure that we're not being attacked from within as well.
It's very interesting that you bring up that point, because I know that you wanted to talk about discrimination, particularly against the LGBTQ plus community. And I found that Attorney General James, the New York State Attorney General, she pointed out that while we celebrate, this is a quote, while we celebrate pride and recognize all the progress made in the 52 years since Stonewall, the LGBTQ plus community is still fighting every day for their most fundamental rights. And she says it is well past time for us to codify federal protections for LGBTQ plus individuals and make good on our country's promise of equal protection under the law for all Americans, regardless of sexual orientation, gender identity, race, ethnicity, or religion. But she says her office will continue to stand for LGBTQ plus neighbors until they're able to celebrate who they are and whom they love without the fear of unfair treatment. Does the general society, which may not be predominantly, and I don't think is predominantly gay, well, I don't know if we know exactly what the figures are, but I don't think the figures really matter. If there are people who are not living on equal footing, then they're literally not able to celebrate who they are. And why do people think that there's something harmful if you believe, not if you personally, but if anybody believes in making love to someone of their own gender or feel comfortable with someone, why does that seem to impose a fear against people who may believe in a different lifestyle? Where does that fear come from? I mean, if you believe in one thing, does that mean that I cannot respect you because you believe in one thing and I believe in something else? Or shouldn't we feel comfortable just believing that you have a right to your beliefs, I have a right to my beliefs, how you live your life and how I live my life may be different, but that doesn't mean we cannot respect one another. Even if we, we traverse the spectrum, because I hear there are many people who may believe that they may count themselves as gay or straight, but then there is also a pendulum swing. And for some people, it's experimentation, and for others, it's finding a different lifestyle that they may or may not adopt. What's so difficult about this? Because I can't even imagine as a father how one would abrogate their relationship with their own child. I don't see how you could dismiss that. Yeah. I just don't get it.
So, you know, first I want to say, you know, the Attorney General is absolutely right. You know, we've made a lot of progress, but, you know, we still have much more work to do. There's this misconception, especially from, you know, cisgender straight people saying, well, marriage equality passed, you know, don't you have enough? And that's just so offensive, because we don't have our basic human rights. And I want to acknowledge that all policy is queer rights policy, because this is a human rights discussion. And we can, you know, I'm not going to go too much into it, but the whole problem of, you know, marriage equality was a great cause, but that was led by, you know, predominantly white male forces, you know, especially in New York City. And, you know, black and brown people were not included heavily in that discussion. And, you know, So scientifically speaking, sexual orientation, gender identity, these are things that exist on a spectrum, no matter who you are. And the queer liberation movement has always been about bringing this forward, bringing this reality forward that, you know, these topics exist on a spectrum and that all people, and I mean that, all people should be able to be who they inherently are. And that includes people who identify as straight and cisgender. And I think regardless of the topic, we have this misconception in the U.S. that justice is finite, that there's not enough rights to go around, that we're going to run out of rights. And I think it's because people have felt so disenfranchised in the U.S. because, again, of the oligarchy that we live in, that, you know, people who are self-interested and egocentric in our politics of both parties, you know, kind of taking voters for granted and just saying, you know, believing in the false idea of incrementalism, that, you know, the government can only focus on one thing at a time, and that's just not true. And I think because people have been so beaten down, especially, you know, working class people over time, but then they fear, you know, this the queer people, you know, Black Indigenous people of color, people with disabilities, you know, marginalized people are somehow going to come about and take their rights because they've already been so neglected by their government. And, you know, we need to refocus on not fighting each other, but fighting those in power. And coming together and saying, that's not true. All of us need our rights, and we can do that. And we need to reorient our objective here, our targets. And going more off what the Attorney General was saying, in less than an hour, there's going to be a rally in Yonkers outside of Andrea Stewart-Cousins' office. Again, at noon, Planned Parenthood, Hudson Peconic, and the New York Civil Liberties Union, NYCLU, they are going to be, talking about and rallying for the Equality Amendment. Governor Hochul's having a special legislative session this Thursday, and, the legislators are going to come back, and, you know, us, the many groups are pushing for, we need to have the Equality Amendment on the table, and we need to pass it. A lot of people don't realize that in New York State, we don't have broad discrimination protections on the basis of race, color, ethnicity, national origin, disability, sex, pregnancy, sexual orientation, gender identity, and gender expression. We have them in certain areas, but even a state like New York, we do not have these broad discrimination protections, and that's what the Equality Amendment would do. And unfortunately, Andrea, Carl, they haven't put it on the agenda for a vote. And, you know, it's kind of offensive because Andrea, Shelley Mayer, they were recently having a webinar on Pride Month, and apparently all the quote-unquote accomplishments that have passed, you know, this legislative session in terms of, queer rights. And, you know, there are some that are important that did pass, of course. You know, we now have an equity fund for trans and non-binary people who have been socioeconomically, discriminated against. And, you know, that's great. But definitely there's a lot of bills, especially on the Education Committee, that would uplift especially our queer youth and all students and educators that would not that were not brought to a committee vote. And, I do want to acknowledge
why
objectively.
Why isn't it brought up to a committee vote?
Just quickly, too, I want to be objective and say, you know, Shelley is a co-sponsor of the Equality Amendment, so this is more Andrea not bringing it to a vote, and that's why this, or bringing it to the agenda, so that's why this rally is happening in less than an hour, which, of course, you're welcome to come.
I don't travel that well anymore, so I'm not going to be able to make it there in time.
No problem.
I guess to me, it's the same old stuff. There's just a lot of I don't know, verbal diarrhea that goes nowhere. I'm just sick and tired of the, same old that goes nowhere. And I really, I'm really offended by language that's so unclear and so circuit. You don't know where these people stand. And I resent the fact that people say one thing in one event and do something else in another event. And this way they can equivocate on no matter what side that they're talking to. So I'm looking for people who are straightforward. Excuse the term. So yeah. it's just very interesting. Anyway, I don't have much respect for some of these people who just don't follow through. They talk a good game, but they don't follow through. And so that's very disheartening.
Yeah. Yeah. And to answer your question.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just, no, it's all good. I was just going to answer your question about, you asked why aren't these bills moving forward? And there's, out of committee or getting a committee vote and, a lot of these bills, that go through the education committee, whether it's the Student Suicide Prevention Act, the LGBTQI curriculum bill, trans and non-binary, student discrimination and protections, the comprehensive sexuality education, like the list just goes on and on of these bills that aren't just acts, blanket acts of inclusivity. These bills would save lives, just to pick one, let's say the trans and non-binary anti-discrimination requirements in schools bill, people don't realize that, a Harvard study recently came out that compiled the information from many other studies that concluded that, 36% of trans and non-binary youth reported being sexually assaulted when they were forced to use locker rooms and bathrooms that didn't correlate with their sense of gender identity. This is why it's not just a blanket, we want to be inclusive. There is harm, there is violence, and there is death occurring when we don't. I'm getting a little emotional.
Why is it so difficult? For example, if you're looking at a school where they have male, they have bathrooms for men, they have bathrooms for women. Can't they devote like one bathroom for people who define themselves as transgender? What is so difficult about finding a remedy that would not create this violence, and that this way they feel secure in going to that facility as opposed to another where they do get abused? I don't understand what's so difficult about that.
Yeah. So
there are a lot of bathrooms in the school, aren't there?
Yeah. We have a bill that, that I think it was a great start. It was Assemblymember Danny O'Donnell's bill that is now the law passed that says that, all, places in New York State, including schools, must have all single occupancy bathrooms must be gender neutral. And then specifically in schools, at least one option of trans and non-binary youth, if they want to feel safe, especially for non-binary youth, that they have at least one option to have a gender neutral bathroom. This doesn't include multiple occupancy bathroom. Those are still binary. But even then, when we talk about trans men are men, trans boys are boys, trans women are women, and trans girls are girls. They should be able to use the men or women's, the boys or girls bathroom, and we're seeing when they're not able to use these bathrooms, the results that come forward that are extremely violent. And people don't realize these are happening in our schools, our K-12 schools. It's disgusting and it's going overlooked. And I think people, again, it goes back to the demonization, we're seeing these groups, queer people as perverted for some reason, and that there's this myth that goes around that, let's say, a trans woman who is homeless wants to use a women's homeless shelter, that somehow their objective is to go in mm-hmm. and sexually assault cisgender women. And that there is no evidence of that whatsoever. And those mm-hmm. protections were actually stripped away during the Trump administration. But now that, you know, I personally believe the Biden administration could do much more. But, you know, I want to give the Biden administration credit for, you know, now those protections are back in place for trans people. But there's this because of this idea that they're queer people are perverted, that there it's no evidence based. It's all pathos. It's all feeling that somehow people would be violated through this inclusivity. And that's just not true. There are no statistics. There are no proven evidence that this would occur. But even then, like when we do studies like this to prove it, it's so offensive because mm-hmm. we don't do studies to prove that cisgender people are, let's say it was, you know, vice versa, you know, there would be no studies that were occurring of like, oh, let's see if cisgender people are raping trans people, you know, because we see that as the default. And, you know, we need to do incredible social and cultural change in this country to then have the governmental influence that we need. Because without that, there's not going to be any actual structural change. And then just to answer the part of like, why are these bills, if we know that this is the truth, and then why are Democrats then in New York State stalling these bills? And, you know, I believe it has a lot to do with, let's say, education mandates, for example. In my opinion, a lot of moderate and centrist Democrats in the past have made performative, empty education mandates, and it left our teachers, you know, regardless of the topic, left our teachers without the resources and the training that they needed to execute these bills that turned into law. And, you know, rightfully, a lot mm-hmm. of the teachers' unions said, we can't allow that anymore because of the people that they represent. So now moderates and centrists are trying to do damage control from the damage they cause themselves and kind of say, you know, okay, we're not going to pass any education mandates now because we don't want to upset teachers' unions. We don't want to upset parents, you know. And, you know, let's say, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. was a firm believer. You know, I can't think of the quote in the moment, but thinking of, I'm going to paraphrase it, that, you know, peace is not the absence of tension, but the presence of justice, you know, and they don't want to do mm-hmm. that important stirring of the pot that needs to happen to get at the structural roots of this issue. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we want to continue, you know, activists that are for these bills want to continue to, you know, make sure, you know, doing these public campaigns, letting people know we educators will be at the table, you know, and they already are with these education mandates to make sure they are not left in the dust and all the responsibility is not left on them, because we need to make these bills the law, and they need to be mandates because, you know, and one last point, the trans and non-binary anti-discrimination requirements in schools bill that is only existing now, and the only reason it was created is because DASA, the Dignity for All Students Act, you know, it claimed to have gender identity, gender expression protections for students, but it was recommendations. It was basically asking school districts, you know, if you want, please be nice. So there was mm-hmm. no requirement to see gender identity, okay. gender expression as, uh-huh. you know, don't discriminate against these people. And, you know, now we have to pass bills like these.
And do people understand what cisgender is? Because I understand it's the way you were born. Is the way you can define yourself, or that you define yourself by your birth, whether you were male or female, and then when does that change? How does one know
yeah.
when you're one way or the other? Do we know?
Yeah, so I would love, I think I should have started with giving some, you know, definition, so I appreciate you bringing that up. Cisgender means that your sense, your internal sense of gender identity matches or correlates with your sex assigned at birth. Meaning if you identify as a man and then the medical community gave you the label of male at birth, you are cisgender. If you are transgender, it means that your internal sense of gender identity does not correlate with your sex assigned at birth. So, you know, one example of being, let's say, transgender is if you identify as a woman, but the medical community assigned you male at birth, you are a trans woman. However, when I say it doesn't correlate, that doesn't mean it's somehow a negative connotation, that somehow that's wrong, because the basis should always be gender identity. You know, you weren't given, you had no choice when you were labeled, you know, male, female, et cetera, at birth. Your internal sense of gender identity, and I want to reiterate too, a lifestyle is a choice. Who you are as a person is not a choice. People who are trans, people who queer or anything, they're not choosing to be, you know, I ask people when they say, you know, when they believe that being queer is a choice, I ask them, when did you choose to be straight? When did you choose to be cisgender? And normally the answer is, I don't remember making that choice. And it's like, of course, you didn't make that choice. That's just who you are, just like queer people. And, you know, definitely
so,
I would...
People don't understand that, do they? People don't understand that? Because
I think it's getting
better. They don't know.
Yeah,
what
I think, I think
better,
it's getting
that people
better.
People recognize that their sexuality is... Well, the sexuality must be hormonally driven, isn't it? To some extent,
if
you don't decide, you're going to go one way or the other.
Correct. There is no choice. And I want to reiterate this.
A very broad spectrum.
Yeah. You know, it's not this, we have this binary view of sexual orientation and gender identity in the U.S. It's a very Western type of thinking. And that's just not the case. It is for many people, but I'll give myself as an example. You know, when you look at the acronym LGBTQ, the Q can stand for either queer or questioning. I'm not questioning, but I am queer, both in sexual orientation and gender identity. And that's just who I am. You know, it's been a journey of figuring out who I am, but there was no choice or, you know, shift, really. It's just, I'm not a gender identity in my personal sense of sexual orientation is irrelevant. I'm attracted more to gender expression. And my internal sense of gender identity, I'm, you know, my pronouns are they, he, she. It's hard to misgender me. I believe, you know, my sense of identity in both cases is more of a spectrum. You know, that's just what it is. You know, even inside the queer community, a lot of bisexual people are still discriminated against, you know, from other queer people. And that's a lot of work that we have to do, you know, internally as well.
So people do run the spectrum of the sexuality and it is fluid. So at time you may feel, you feel male or sometimes you may feel female or neither. Or you just haven't defined it yet. Does that happen to everybody in different degrees? I would suspect.
Yeah, different
but
degrees.
Some people are more butch than others. Some people are more feminine than others. You can't. I don't know how to define them. I don't look at people that way and say, well, that person is defined one way or the other. I don't know. Do we wear a label? Says one thing or the other? Do we even understand each other that way?
Yeah.
I don't know how we define each other.
Yeah, I think, you know, the important underlying thing here is it's okay to, you know, the difference between ignorance and not knowing something is ignorance is willfully mm-hmm. not understanding and not wanting to learn
willfully.
Facts.
Right.
Yeah, willfully. Okay. Whereas I think everyone needs to give themselves grace in not understanding mm-hmm. certain things, especially queer issues, because if you want to learn more, you know, that should never, ever be judged. I think, you know, tapping, mm-hmm. it's a sense of vulnerability to say, you know what, I don't know enough about this topic, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, look, you can look into these topics and learn more, because at the end of the day, if you don't know something, the answer is basic human respect. You know, if you don't know someone's mm-hmm. pronouns, how they identify, use they, them pronouns, because people don't understand that's plural, and it has always also been a singular pronoun. You know, let's say you see someone mm-hmm. in the distance and you don't know who they are. Would use they, you know, like they are over there, you know, can you point to the uh-huh. person that you're talking about, them? I think long story short, it's okay to not know something as long as you are willing, you're willing to learn more about it. And, you know, there, like you said, there are gender fluid people. There are people who, mm-hmm. you know, maybe one day want to identify as this and the next they don't. And that's, you know, gender fluid people are also, they know who they are, they can identify as gender fluid. And then there's some people who are still learning about themselves. We all go through a journey of understanding who
yeah,
we are. But also
sure.
statistically, the majority of the LGBTQ community are bisexual people, and a lot of people don't mm-hmm. know that.
No, I don't think that's discussed. It's not in the vernacular, not that much that I'm aware of. It is interesting, like when I learned English, because English is not my first language, mm-hmm. when I learned English, I used to, I think I was actually taught by someone who is British. I don't have a British accent, though, because, you know, I never lived in England. And I guess that's gone in the wayside now and probably sound a little bit more American, even though when I record my own voice, I said, oh, my God, I could hear the accent. But whatever it is, what's interesting is, you know, I used to use terms like one, you know, meaning one can be so-and-so, not that you define them as he or she and so on and so forth. But that was very British, old world. But it seems to be coming into American English now all of a sudden, you know, using terms like they as opposed to him or her. It is very interesting. Things are changing slightly, even when it comes to language. And where does that come from? Is that being, you know, appropriate? It's not because there's a difference to people. Sexual persuasion might be different than maybe the mainstream, whatever the mainstream is. Is that where it's coming from? Is that coming from the gay community?
Yeah.
These terms?
Language, people don't realize language is always evolving. These internal senses of who we are, these internal sense of identities have always existed. We are just now coming to a place, you know, in the U.S. and internationally where we are finding and we have the ability to create and find language to identify
mm-hmm.
who we are. The definitions have always existed, you know,
mm-hmm.
and you know, people have this, like, again, this fear of like, oh, why is the why is the rate of queer people increasing, quote unquote increasing? You know, they fear somehow that the human species is not gonna live on because the queer people, you know, what they think is increasing. And my answer is, the number isn't increasing. It's these people who are finally able to come out of the closet and say who they are. They've mm. always existed, because in the past
mm-hmm.
they just died living a false life because they feared discrimination
mm-hmm.
and violence. So Yeah, I would say language evolves, and the language, we're just finding the language now to identify who we are, and I would ask people to just not fear wanting to adjust their language. You know, there's many ways, there's many, like you said, that one can be, et cetera, et cetera. That's gender neutral. They, them is gender neutral. Calling someone by their name is gender neutral if you don't know what their pronouns are. You know, there's many people who don't, they forget how I identify, and that's okay because they're using gender neutral language. You know, also my first pronoun.
So they can use your name? So they can use your name rather than he, she, they, whatever?
Yeah, if
that's
someone
okay.
forgot, if you forget someone's pronouns that they use, you can use their name. Say, I was talking with Max recently about this topic, you know, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And is that starting to permeate the language, do you think? Do you see that happening more and more? I still find it, when I would write a sentence, one would know, normally would never say that in American English. You know, it just doesn't, it's anathema to American English. So a very old world. So it's hard to know. But is that creeping into American English? You find it more acceptable?
I would say it has always existed. Yeah, I would say it's always existed in American English. I would just say it, more people are tapping into it. Just the larger issue, you want to go back into socio-political topics. You're seeing more and more, and I don't want to give too much credit to, you know, the Republican Party or any political party, because they can't get, no political party can gatekeep human rights issues. But even seeing articles from young Republican people saying, you know, we find it so barbaric that we're still wasting our time talking about the human rights of queer people. That should just be inherent, you know. And again, I don't want to – the log cabin Republicans who are LGBTQ people who are conservative, they're supporting horrible people like Marjorie Taylor Greene. They're a joke, you know. They're constantly laughed at. I don't even want to give them – attention because they're causing harm to their own community. But you know, we're shifting. The incoming generation of people are saying, like, this is ridiculous. We want to be talking about other issues because these people should already have their human rights. And but at the same time, though, I think it's also an excuse when people say, you know, oh, I have hope for the incoming generation. Well, people who aren't part of the incoming generation, like you, who are doing the hard work, they can be a part of this as well, because, you know, there's damage happening right now that we're not, we can't just say, oh, it's going to be fixed by the incoming generation. Some of it will not be fixable by that time. So we all need to be allies. We all need to be advocates right now.
Well, are we teaching compassion and respect for other people, whoever the other is, or have we just lost it somehow, somewhere along the way? I'm an old guy already, so I'm in my 70s, so I don't know exactly if we ever had respect for people before, or we thought we did because we didn't know who they were, or how they defined themselves. Or we would demonize them if we found out that they believed in one thing or another. So what's changing that? Is that self-respect? I guess
self-respect
came first before we respected others.
Yeah, I think people need to realize that self-respect means that you want to be treated. You have to treat everyone else like you want to be treated, but also just be for the sake of being a kind person. you know, in this country, I think a lot of people get upset and they get defensive when we have to face the reality that this country was built on violence and bloodshed. And, you know, whether that be with the indigenous people, slavery, we need to face head on our historical reality. And a lot of it is, you know, whether the language is being used or not, people across this country are understanding and tapping into the innate sense to be compassionate towards fellow humans. I think especially in this current political climate where everyone is on the defense and they feel like they need to attack each other, more and more people are surrendering and saying, you know, we need to, like, they can't do this anymore for their own well-being. Mm-hmm. We cannot treat each other as the other. You know, of course, I think it depends on the area. It's both are occurring at the same time, you know. Bigotry, fascism is on the rise, while at the same time, more and more people are also standing up for one another. I think that both are occurring at the same time, oddly enough, and, you know, we just have to continue having the hard conversations at the dinner table that need to be had. Having these conversations at the workplace, when you see something that is not going right, you need to call it out. You know, recently, actually, I'll do an example. It was like a few days ago. I was at Trader Joe's doing grocery shopping, and someone called me the F slur, you know, that is derogatory towards queer people. And many people stood up for me, you know, straight, cisgender people.
Really?
It was about four or five people, men, women, different age demographics, that said, no, you're not going to do that. And that person ended up, you know, they were intimidated because they were being hateful, and they put their groceries down and they just left without even checking out. So when I see stuff like
that,
I have
come from. Where does that come from? I mean, does that person know you even?
No,
they didn't. But why would anyone shout that out?
It's fear.
Outrageous.
It's fear. It's
of
fear.
What? What are you going to infect him?
Yeah,
or
it's
her,
fear of not of what they. Yeah, it was a hurt. They feel. They have fear of what they don't know, and then also just it's proven one of the, you know. Also, I want to say queer existence isn't just political, but it is definitely political. You know, they say Pride was a riot, and that's what the first Pride was. It was a riot against violence.
Yeah, it was
but
a riot.
Anyway, yeah. But, you know, one of the main influencers of politics, you know, first is family, and the second is religion. And when we have extremely outdated views, especially with what people who call themselves Christian in this country, I promise you, if Jesus rose from the dead, he would be appalled by some of the people that are calling themselves Christian. And, you know, spreading this hate and these outdated views of, you know, that are even promoting violence
when
against
it comes
Muslims
to religion,
people.
There were comments that I didn't even pass them along, I don't think, on my website, because I approve all comments that get posted, and if I don't, then I just don't. But maybe I did or I wasn't sure, but I think I needed to respond to one of them, and I couldn't understand. Oh, yeah, somebody said that all the Abrahamic religions did not condone, and they, homosexuality in any form. And it's very interesting. I speak many, many languages. And what I found fascinating is that while people profess to know all the different religions, I doubt seriously if they've studied all those other religions that they talk about. And they don't even speak the language of these other religions. I speak two of those that are major religions. And if you understand the language and you understand the roots of the words, then you also understand the duality of some of the words that were used that show both both sexual aspects of the male or female gender in the same word. And so but people don't understand that. And it's been maligned. A lot of the stuff that's been written in the Abrahamic languages have been maligned because of the ignorance of the people who postulate one way or another on these issues. They're ignorant.
Yeah.
And yet they espouse, and yet they're heard because they're espousing bigotry and not knowledge. Because if they did, I think then it may turn everything upside down because a lot of people just don't know. It's fascinating how you can perpetuate ignorance and it keeps on going. And
I want to say
about religion of all places.
Yeah, and I want to say too quick, you know, I don't want to take up too much time that,
mm-hmm.
you know, it doesn't even, in the end of the day, this country has separation of church and state for a reason. So when these
mm-hmm.
people are having these discussions and they're saying, well, the Bible says here or that blah, 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 or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you know, book they're referencing, I don't care.
Yeah.
Your moral basis is not the universal basis of this country. There is a separation of church and state. I don't care
mm-hmm.
what religion you are. And at the same time, I'm going to fight for your religious freedom. But that
mm-hmm.
doesn't mean you get to push your religious outdated views in the governmental sense on me. You know, and we can...
Mm-hmm.
This goes to abortion rights as well. You don't have the right to control
yeah.
someone's bodily autonomy because you think the Bible
mm-hmm.
says this, the Bible says that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care. I don't care what your religious views are because they are irrelevant in terms of how our government needs to operate. There is a separation of church and state, and you should be able to practice whatever religion and whatever beliefs you hold, but you cannot force those beliefs onto others. Again, you know, because abortion care is inherently a queer rights issue because it's a health care issue, you know,
mm-hmm.
If you don't want an abortion, don't get one. That's up to you
mm-hmm.
because you can control yourself. You cannot control other people. You cannot tell queer people that they need to go back into the shadows. And we're not going to because we have that revolutionary spirit in us and we're going to continue to fight back.
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't, you know, it's funny, I've just been listening to you. I haven't even looked at the clock, so I didn't realize how late it is. But any final words from you as we approach the last 8 minutes of the broadcast?
Yeah. First, I want to say thank you for having me on. You know, I'm glad that we went over time, actually, as long as I wasn't interrupting anything. And, I would just ask people, look closely at your political figures, queer or not.
Mm-hmm.
Are they truly an advocate or are they trying to uplift themselves in their own interests,
mm-hmm.
in their own careers? And
mm-hmm.
look closely at the landscape and say, do we deserve better? Are we doing enough? While at the same time, no, be vulnerable with yourself. It's okay that you don't know things. And you can be an ally while continuing to learn more, and that's okay.
Well, that is really terrific. Unfortunately, I'm going to need to shut down because I'm getting a delivery of medication that's coming
mm-hmm.
in. So let me say goodbye. It turned out it worked out propitiously. And thanks again. I hope you'll consider coming back again.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Be well. Thanks. Bye.